studies show that we have less friends than we ever have before. We have less people that we rely on. And why is that? Why is it when the world population is going up and we think that we're more connected, we are actually less connected? I may be talking to somebody in New York City at the moment, but I live in an apartment building where I don't know the person two doors down, you know.
Welcome to Permission to Heal. I am Marcy Brockman, and I am so glad you're here. In this podcast, we engage in meaningful, deeply human conversations using our voices to inspire connection, compassion, understanding, empathy, and wholehearted wellness. I want you to find the courage to transform yourself no matter what others tell you. Only you can give yourself permission to trust yourself, permission to take care of yourself, permission to follow your heart and desires, and build a life of love, home, and belonging. Through sharing our stories, we will help each other to heal and create the healthy, meaningful lives we richly deserve. We only need our own permission to begin. I am very proud of this Permission to Heal podcast. I want to thank all of you for listening each week, and I'm so glad that it speaks to you. Creating and producing this podcast brings joy to my life, but I honestly need your help because I find commercials annoying when I listen to podcasts. I don't have commercials on Permission to Heal, so I am missing out on potential advertising revenue. I pay for the costs of creating, producing, and marketing this podcast out of my own pocket, and I'm happy to do so, except that times are kind of tough right now, and I could use your help. So through Patreon and a Patreon subscription, you can support the Permission to Heal podcast and help ensure that I'm able to make more episodes and share them with the world. There are several subscription levels that come with different perks and swag. If you're able to, and if you are inclined to, I would really, really appreciate your help. Please go to www.patreon.com/permission to heal. Patreon, patreon.com/permission to heal. And it's linked in the show notes. So scroll down, click away. Thank you so much for your consideration. I hope you and your families are well and happy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Permission to Heal. I am Marcy Brockman, and I am thrilled that you are here. On today's episode of Permission to Heal, we have Dr. Christian Heim from Sydney, Australia. He is an award-winning psychiatrist. He's the author of several books. He's a musician. He's just a lovely, lovely gentleman. And we had a lovely conversation about his new book, The Seven Love Types, Navigating Love in a Fractured World. We both agree that what this world really needs is more love, to coin a bazillion songs out there. But we're all fractured. We're all separated from each other. We're all consumed with devices and work and productivity and a pandemic that's ruptured our relationships throughout the world. And what we really need to help combat our mental health crisis is more love in the world. Dr. Christian takes us back to the ancient Greeks and their different languages for the different vocabulary words for the different types of love. My students and I have been talking recently in class about the fact that indigenous Arctic peoples have hundreds of words for the word snow, different ways to describe the word snow. And us seemingly primitive English speakers have one word for love, every kind of love that there is, whether it's the love I have for my husband or the love for my children or the love for my good friends or the love I have for my coworkers or the love I have for my students or my cats or the love I have for sushi or the love I have for music or the love I have for the people who I stand on the line at the grocery store with. It's all different, very different. It feels different to them. It feels different to me. It feels different to all of us. And yet we all use the word, the same word. And so I think it's an interesting way of pulling apart how we actually feel and realizing that because there are so many different types of love, every single interpersonal relationship that we have uses many of them, sometimes simultaneously, sometimes in quick succession, sometimes cyclically, depending on what's going on in our lives. And I think that knowing all of this helps us create a more meaningful, more well-connected, more loving and self-loving life. And who doesn't want that? Anyway, so stay tuned. Here is the episode with Dr. Christian. Welcome, Dr. Christian Heim. How are you today?
Thank you very much, Marcy. I am very excited to be here. I'm very excited to talk about something that's passionate to all of us, and that is love.
Love. You have written a new book called The Seven Love Types, Navigating Love in a Fractured World that I can't wait to get into with you. What made you want to write this book?
Okay, so Marcy, I'm a clinical psychiatrist, which means I help people through some of the darkest times of their life, some of the most challenging problems that we have on the planet personally. And so what I start to think about is how could we prevent these problems in the first place? And something that comes up very, very strongly is how difficult it is to find love and to find caring, even with family and friends these days. And then I got to thinking, this whole idea of love, which we've learned a lot about scientifically over the last 20 years, is still a very nebulous area because we have this one word, love, and it means so many different things. It means love of animals, love of children, love of friends, love of family, love of lovers.
Right.
Love of golf and music, for goodness sake.
Love of
How
sushi.
How can we use just one word? Love of sushi, that's right. That's right. So I decided to look at this thing and to see how we can actually understand love, not only scientifically, but using ancient wisdom as well.
Beautiful. Beautiful. I was talking to my 12th grade English students this week. We were reading a whole bunch of, I love weird stories. Okay.
Okay.
So we've been reading a bunch of very odd, offbeat short stories about in dysfunctional relationships.
Yes.
And we're sort of, since my big push is mental health this year as an English teacher, we're looking at all of these characters, all of these couples from a mental health standpoint. And what is it about them? What anger, shame, blame, embarrassment, vulnerability, whatever is causing them to act the way they're trying to act? I'm trying to impart more learning to my students besides, you know, how does the author use symbolism? Because who the hell cares about that? Really. And we're having this conversation about how we've got one word for every single different type of love that there is. And it gets very confusing when you're trying to navigate what a character is doing in a short story or when you're trying to navigate what you're doing in your own life.
Yes.
And maybe we need more words to describe the things that we're doing and thinking and feeling.
Yes. Yes. And so that is the central idea where I decided to look at seven different types of love. And so I use the Greek words for it, but then I give translation so that we understand what we're actually talking about. Okay. So let's say we're talking about belonging love, the love that you feel just being part of a family. You didn't choose your family. You were born into it. You're part of it. You belong to this family. And because of that belonging, you feel love.
Right.
But belonging love is also actually broader than that because you belong, let's say, to a group of students who are in an English class. And so there's a sense of belonging in that English class. And
so is it anywhere where you have a community?
That's right. That sense of belonging to a community. This is why we love our hometown, however small it is, however large it is. You just feel that you belong there. And that evokes a sense of love. But of course, that is a very different sort of love to if you enter a personal relationship with somebody, or if you actually make a friend of somebody, or if you encounter a stranger and you make a connection very quickly with a stranger. What is that? Is that a type of love? Yes, I believe it is.
Yeah. Yeah. There are a few people that I've met in my life, including my friend I was telling you about before, who lives in Brisbane. The minute we met, it was like we had known each other our entire lives.
Yes.
When obviously it had only been 10 minutes, you know, but there was just some connection. And I would call that love, but it's certainly not the same love I have for my children or the love I have for my husband or the love I have for my cats. They were all different.
Right. They're all very different loves. So we can start looking at the different types of love. So let's say we started off with strangers. Well, to love a stranger means you've got to love something that is very foreign to you first. And so the Greeks had this word xenia love, and it's not Princess Xenia, but let's say in medicine, if you give somebody a pig's valve for their heart, that's called a xenograft. It is a piece of flesh from a foreign animal. So we get this word xenia, which means love for strangers.
And is it the same root as xenophobia?
Yes, it is. Xenophobia means
you're being very cautious
or afraid of strangers. Okay. Xenophilia is loving strangers. So you get people who call themselves Francophiles. They love anything French, or Anglophiles. They love anything English, but it's foreign to them as a person. And whenever we invite somebody for a meal or we give them a shelter for the night, we're expressing a type of love that is actually very ancient. And all these rituals that we have, like breaking the ice with a glass of wine or a glass of a beer or a cup of coffee, these are all rituals that we have to make interacting with strangers safe.
Right.
Because it's really hard to go for your sword when you've got a drink in your hand, you see.
Very hard.
So we've developed all these rituals so that love can actually grow. Also, there's respect. And anybody who's in a love relationship knows that at times, your partner is going to say something that's just totally foreign to you. You didn't know this side of them. And you go, oh, my gosh, they are a stranger to me at this moment.
Right.
So what we do is we use the seven love types to say, okay, in that moment, you treat them like a stranger so that your actual erotic love can grow. But for a moment, they're a stranger. And so it becomes the same kind of principle.
Interesting. Interesting. So the whole point of it really is to keep navigating all of our interpersonal relationships so that even within one relationship, if I'm hearing you correctly, you can have many different types of love.
Yes. Yes. So when I do, let's say, couples therapy with a couple that are on the verge of breaking up, they think, oh, we've got to get more love. So what they do is they try to ramp up the date nights. They try to ramp up the romance. They try to ramp up the candlelight dinners and put more sex into the relationship, when maybe what they need to be doing is looking at the friendship side of their relationship or look at the respect and stranger side of the relationship. Or we spoke about belonging before. When you've been in a relationship for 15 or 20 years, you feel that you belong together, even through the difficulties. So looking at that type of is helpful. Or let's take liking love. Like you said that you like cats. So the Greeks call this epithumia. They are things that you like. You love cats. Some people love music. And so people in a relationship, they look for common ground. What do we like together? Mm-hmm. Do we like surfing? Do we like four-wheel driving? Do we like walking and hiking? And these things become very precious in a relationship. And so it becomes a belonging love inside the context of a romantic relationship.
And I would imagine with the ebb and flow of life and the difficulties and the challenges and and everyone's moods and everyone else's mental health and everything else that goes on living in 2022 on this planet, that just there are some times where you might not feel the erotic kind of love for your wife or your husband. And
well, that's
takes it to a back seat for a little while you're navigating. Okay, so let's just do the co-parenting friend thing right now so that we can get through this difficult patch. And then just trust that if we ride this out together, that the erotic love will bloom again when the stress is over, kind of thing.
Marcy, that's exactly right. And what you articulated there is one of the limitations of the scientific view of love. Because science, being all about the function, how we navigate this world to survive, really equates love and sex, that we have love basically so that people will keep together to create the future generation of the species, and so that we will parent well. That's all very scientific, but there are
times. Reduces us to dopamine and oxytocin.
Oh, dopamine, oxytocin, beta endorphins, serotonin.
Right, but we're more than a bag of chemicals.
That's right. We are much more than a bag of chemicals. And as a psychiatrist, this is what I enjoy, journeying with people who I know are much more than chemicals. So my work has to be informed by the science. We have to talk about the chemicals, but there's more than that. And that exactly articulates the reason that I went to the ancient Greeks for their wisdom, because for as long as we have been walking this earth, we've been discussing ideas of love mm-hmm. and what keeps relationships together and what makes life worth living. That's not a 20th century or 21st century phenomenon.
No, it's an existential question from the beginning of time.
Exactly. Yeah.
And if it's not our interpersonal relationships that is the meaning of life, then what the hell is?
Yes, yes. And interpersonal relationships always rates very highly as one of probably the thing that makes life worth living the most. So Aristotle actually said that interpersonal relationships contribute to happiness more than anything else. So wind forward to the 21st century, Martin Seligman in his Positive Psychology talks about the importance of interpersonal relationships to our quality of life. But Marcy, we live in a world that is taking us away from our interpersonal relationships. Studies show that we have less friends. Yes, yes, you've got that phone there. We've got less friends than we ever have before. We have less people that we rely on. And why is that? Why is it when the world population is going up and we think that we're more connected, we are actually less connected? I may be talking to somebody in New York City at the moment, but I live in an apartment building where I don't know the person two doors down, you know.
Well, I live in a suburb surrounded. I live in a town of about 15,000 people, and maybe I know 20 of them. Yes. I knew many more of them when my children were in the public school system here, but, you know, that gets fractured when the kids graduate and move away. But of all of the people who live on my street, I know one family.
Yes.
They live right next door. Otherwise, I don't talk to anybody.
Yes.
You know, I grew up in a neighborhood in the 1970s where everybody knew everybody. All of the kids played, all of the parents socialized to some degree or another.
Yes.
But by the 90s, that wasn't the same way. It wasn't the same thing. There's been a radical shift.
There has been a very radical shift. And because of that, we lose our sense of belonging. That storge love, that's what the Greeks called the belonging love. We don't feel that we belong to a town anymore, because we can all be in a bedroom or a living room with a device such as a computer or a cell phone, and you feel connected to the world. But the world is not real people. Real people are flesh and blood that you can look into their eyes and communicate with and feel that you are sharing this strange thing called life.
Yeah. Yeah. And the statistics that you quote in your book about this, if I can quote you to you or quote you to the audience, you said in the United States, for example, over 47,000 people took their own lives in 2017, a 4% increase in 2016 and a 33% increase in 1999.
Yeah.
In 2018, it was 48,000 something or other, was another large increase. 15 times as many people suffer from schizophrenia than are on dialysis. 20 times as many people suffer from bipolar disorder as then suffer from stroke each year. Yep. And depression has outstripped heart disease in causing the most disability worldwide. Under 18-year-olds, it's increased by 63%. And under 35-year-olds by 47%. Anxiety in children increased over 20% over 10 years. We've got an epidemic of mental illness here. I see this as a public school teacher. My student, I mean, you can attribute it to the COVID coronavirus pandemic, but only to a certain extent. I think that what the pandemic did was exacerbate the problem that we already had. And at the same time, shine a spotlight on it.
Yes.
So now at least we're looking at it. But what do we do?
What do we do?
That's the solution.
Well,
what do we do?
Okay. So the thing is that we've had what's called a medical model for many decades now trying to look at mental illness in terms of brain chemicals. Oh, you are depressed because you have a mental imbalance in your brain.
Right.
Now, if it was due to brain chemicals and genetics, then genetic makeup has not changed appreciably for about 60,000 years now.
Right.
Why this huge increase? So it becomes clear that this has less to do with brain chemicals and more to do with a problem with our lifestyle. And
Or a problem with toxicity or trauma within our interpersonal relationships.
And then the question becomes, where does that trauma and toxicity come from? And right. Look, we've always had trauma, we've always had toxicity. But the thing is, and Bruce Perry wrote a whole book on how love is protective against trauma.
Right.
It is the love side of the equation that we are losing. And that's why I do see the solution to be love, and which is why in my book I quote psychologists that saw that love is the answer, but not some romantic movie tale of what love is, but actually caring for your fellow human beings,
right.
Caring for yourself in love, nurturing our relationships, nurturing our relationships with our children, and fostering a society that actually is pro-love, where we actually get to have more friends rather than less. But because our technological devices at the moment are so convenient, they are so wonderful, and they are wonderful, but it means that we're spending a lot less time with each other. And that's kind of the thing that we've got to turn around, which is why I put together this book,
right.
Trying to focus people on love again, because we actually really all enjoy love. We just need to be able to understand it, to experience more of it again.
So on a daily basis, like your random non-holiday Tuesday,
for instance,
how do we go about bringing more love into our lives? Talking to strangers that we commute with, commiserating with people at the bus stop.
That all sounds like the way to do it, but it's actually very, very difficult to do.
Right.
So on a very practical level, and this is why I put the video out on social media addiction, on a practical level, it is disengaging from a screen to engage right. with people. Because when you make eye contact with another human being, there's a lot more that happens than just you are looking at their eyes.
Sure.
It is parts of their limbic system, specifically the anterior cingulate gyrus, becomes connected to your anterior cingulate gyrus. And it's like you are magnetically attracted for those moments, and your two brains are transmitting information to each other that we even can't describe. Okay, so in the book, I talk about one thing called the eye contact effect. If you have done something wrong in the eyes of the person that you love and you're looking for forgiveness, that's done through eye contact.
Yes,
and the eye contact says, please forgive me. And
if they don't look at you, you know you're in trouble.
That's right. If they don't look at you. But then when they look at you, you go, oh, thank goodness, I'm still there.
Right.
And so you start to feel this forgiveness. All right, but let's take it away from two people and go, when you make eye contact with a pet, all right, mm-hmm. and the pet can tell if you're in the mood to play. Right. You just need to make eye contact with your dog and he goes, oh boy, are we ready to play? Are we, you know, or you just make eye contact with a dog and the dog goes, you've had a hard day. You just need to give me a pat, don't you? And so the dog comes up here and you give them the pat. So again, through eye contact, through touch, through our facial expressions, our right. brains are interacting a whole lot more than we even realize. But if we interact with cell phone, where we're actually not even open to interacting with another human being. And that's why I'm linking the experience of love with decreasing our experience of screen devices. We don't have to give them up, but we have to right. decrease it, you know.
Decrease it. So with so many family members far away these days, especially with people yes. who are still socially distancing, and there are still people who, you know, we still have incidents yes. of COVID going on. And
yes, we do.
Do we have any of that connection through like this Zoom call or through a FaceTime call? There's no limbic to limbic conversation going on this way, is there?
There is some, just not as much. So okay. for example, as a psychiatrist, I do a lot of work online.
Right.
But I do not work online with anybody unless I had worked with them face-to-face first.
Okay.
Because both of our brains will remember the face-to-face interaction of what it felt like to be in the presence of the other person. And
right.
It's hard to find the words to know what it feels like in another presence of a person.
Sure. But you do know.
It's real. You do know and you do remember it. And so, yeah, we have a son in New York City at the moment, and we haven't seen him face-to-face for a number of years. And we do this, what we're doing at the moment, Zooming, and we say, you know, it doesn't feel the same.
No, of course not.
It doesn't, but you're going to take what you can get.
Of course, so, better to have Zoom and FaceTime and so you can have video conferencing versus when you didn't. I mean, when I went away to college in the mid-1980s, we had landline phones only.
That's right.
And that was
it. That's right.
Postal mail and landline phones.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, this is where it's easy to see that our technology is actually wonderful and we have to use it and we love using it. It's just that when it becomes work, entertainment, movies, music, even when I jog, I've got the iPods in, and you become cut off from everybody around you. Whereas if you just walk down the street, one of my favorite things is just passing a stranger and just making eye contact and just a little acknowledgement. In Australia, we just say g'day. So it's just, it can make your day if you have good interactions like that. But the bigger the city, like you live in New York City, okay, you just walk straight past people and they actually think that you're weird if you make eye contact with them, right? That's because we are socially conditioned not to make eye contact. So all these things are culturally informed by how big the city is, but by
so
and
maybe
largely,
that's why people think I'm weird.
Yeah.
Because well, I make it a habit of talking to everyone that I see.
Yes,
conversation with somebody online at Starbucks. I have a conversation with somebody while pumping gas. I have a conversation with random kids in the hallway at school who I don't know, standing in line at the grocery store. I just chat people up. I remember as a little girl watching my grandmother do this.
Yes.
And she had people who I thought were relative strangers calling her grandma because she she was like Mary Poppins. She just was effusive with love and was just
wonderful,
spreading this kindness and cheer everywhere. And as I've grown up myself, I've wanted to emulate that and copy that in my own life. So people look at me like my mom, my kids, oh, my daughter, when she was a teenager, used to want to hide because I talk to everyone.
Yes. Okay. So some people may think that you're strange, Marcy, but nobody will ever think that you're unfriendly.
Oh, God, no. They just think
that's
I'm
right.
quirky and they roll their eyes at me. Whatever.
Yeah, I don't care. Yeah.
But, I embrace that.
But they still know that you're friendly. Mm-hmm. You are making contact. You're acknowledging somebody else's life and presence. And we all need that. We all actually crave that. If we don't,
and they all smile. Every single person I talk to smiles, sometimes surprisingly, but they all smile. I think it makes their day. And it makes mine.
Yes. And just sharing a smile means that you've had a positive interaction with another human being. Mm-hmm. And that's why it makes your day. And that's a form of Xenia love or stranger love. You just smile, just say hi and get on with each other's day. Or you might show somebody some directions, or you might just share about how gas prices are a bit high today, you know, but these are the little things that keep us going and make life worthwhile, as well as the big things, of course.
Absolutely. So what is your advice about self-love and self-compassion? I think a lot of people have problems with that. I know I am much nicer consistently, much more forgiving, much more respectful, much more generous with other people than I am with myself and my own inner monologue.
Yes.
One thing that I would like to change in myself going forward is being nicer to Marcy. I think on one hand, if I think intellectually, I'm a pretty awesome person and I've got a lot of talents and I'm a very kind, loving person. And the things I say to myself and the inside of my head, I would never in 1,000 years say to another person.
Yes.
So how do I apply this theory of love to myself better?
Okay. So the first thing I want to say, Marcy, is that is actually the normal state of affairs for most people. And over the last 20, 30 years, we've been talking about the importance of self-esteem. And what a lot of that has done has put pressure on us to be kind to ourselves when we don't feel like being kind to ourselves. So I'll talk about a way out of it. So in other words, people fake being kind to themselves when they're actually very hard on themselves. And the thing is that we actually get to hear all of our thoughts. We get to experience all of our feelings. And we get to know that, you know what, there are some not nice things in there as well, which is why self-love is really difficult. So in my book, what I've done is I've put a chapter on self-love, but that's the last chapter. Okay. So what happens is you go through the journey of understanding loving other people before coming to love yourself. Because when you love other people and share yourself with other people, you actually gain respect for yourself. You actually go, you know what? You're worthy of love as well, okay? You've shared all of this. You can feel good about yourself, okay? Whereas if you put yourself first, if you say, I am going to love Marcy first, you actually lose respect for yourself, because if you give yourself love first, what tends to happen is people then put other people second. And so you end up losing respect for yourself because you're not being a loving person, because the nature of love is to love and then be loved in itself. So to give first.
Right.
And it's really difficult. So after you experience giving, like after you've given a smile, you've just passed a stranger and you've given a smile and you got a smile back and you went, oh, see Marcy, somebody else who you've just had a little interaction with.
Right.
That feels good. So I look at self-love because self-love is really important, but it has to be genuine self-love. It can't be a faked or I've got to put myself first before other people type of self-love. So that's why it's last, but it gets a very important look in, and it talks about how through loving other people and understanding love, then it becomes very natural to start accepting and even loving yourself.
So how do you reconcile? I'm listening to what you're saying, and it absolutely makes a lot of sense to me. But then I'm thinking about what I've heard from other therapists and psychologists and other guests on this show, actually, who've said things like, you can't fill other people's cup from your own empty cup, or like using the airplane metaphor where you have to put your own oxygen mask on first before you help anyone else. So is what you're saying at all contradictory to the, you have to take care of your own needs before you have what to give to other people, or does that fit together like a Lego somehow?
No, I'd say it's contradictory. Okay. So I do like stepping on a few toes occasionally, you know. That's right, it does. So let's take the idea of filling your love cup. How does your love cup get filled? Well, none of us actually are born into this life and we start filling our own love cup. We can't do that. We don't have the wherewithal to do that. The people who first fill your love cup are your parents. Then it becomes your family, friends, your peers, and everybody starts to fill your love cup. So in other words, everybody else has given you a dose of love first. So somebody else has given you that love so that you have that reservoir of a love cup so that you can then give to other people. But that is very different to saying, I am going to be first among other people. That, unfortunately, leads towards narcissism, which we have a lot of in this world. And narcissism is basically loving yourself first above other people. So, and none of us actually like the experience of narcissism, but all of us, all of our brains arrange the whole world around ourselves. That there's just no other way to organize the world. So in other words, we all have a very natural inclination towards narcissism, to thinking that the whole world is here just for ourselves. But if we live our lives that way, we're going to find ourselves very lonely. Yeah. So it really is this idea of give and take, give and take, give and take with every interaction. And there is that effort of having to give first before you can take. And so even with yourself, there's that dynamic of giving first and then you're able to take. Because what I find from the idea of looking after your own self-esteem first is that people put themselves first and then they feel bad about themselves. And they start to feel good only when they see they can actually love first. So it's a bit of a balance, but there's a bit of tension there.
So maybe to combine both of those theories instead of making them diametrically opposite is to really just, I hate the word just, makes things sound too simple, is to enact or assemble or whatever healthy boundaries for yourself. What feels good, what's okay and what's not okay. And then within those boundaries, give love freely. Because we all have to get to a point where we're like, I can't say yes to another thing. I have to go home and just sit with a cat and watch TV or take a nap or read a book. Like I can't give anymore. Yes. And so I think if we have the self-compassion and the strength to enact and or erect and maintain healthy boundaries, that coupled with this new paradigm of love could be a good recipe for mental health.
Yes, it is. And the thing is that, Marcy, we're actually not as individualistic as we'd like to believe. We're not 8 billion individuals loving ourselves first and then trying to make relationships with other people. Right. We are all part of this living, breathing organism that we call the human race. And we all speak into each other's lives. So in other words, we all share love with each other and we all take love with each other as well. So either we are being loving when we're connected or we're being unloving when we're disconnected. And so what I'm emphasizing in my book is the idea of being connected with other people, because then more love will flow through you. Mm-hmm. And so it'll be much more natural for you to have more love for yourself because you're part of a whole loving flow. Right. But if you're disconnected from that, then you're actually even disconnected from love from yourself. So rather than being diametrically opposed, there's some contention there, but basically people will agree that the more love, the better. For example, we give out
medals. Get behind that.
Yeah, that's right. We will give out medals in society for people who've been altruistic, who have risked their lives for other people. Mm-hmm. We applaud that. We know that it is a good thing to do. We don't give medals out for people who put themselves before other people.
No, we don't.
Right? No. However, having
done that, we divorce those people.
This is very well put, you know. But as you said, there are times when you have to actually take care of yourself first. So the airplane situation is very valid. Every ambulance officer knows that you have to be safe to be able to take care of other people. But that's actually why you take care of yourself, so that you can take care of somebody else, because you're more likely to take care of yourself if you do it for other people.
Makes sense.
Complex.
I love that. So I was looking, as I was doing your research for this conversation, I was noticing that you and your wife, Caroline, do a video series on YouTube.
Yes. We did for a while. Yeah.
You still doing it, or is that?
Okay. It's kind of morphed. We were in a situation where before the COVID crisis, we were going to move to the USA, closer to our son in New York City, and that kind of put a stop to that. And then Caroline, my spouse, is a lecturer at a university. She's a professor. And we noticed people's mental health just dwindling. And so we put together, firstly, a few videos to help students online. And that morphed into an idea of putting something together, talking about some of the issues that I do talk about in my work and in the things that I write and in the posts that I put up. And so that became this video series that Caroline and I have put on together. Now we're starting to do discrete videos that talk about particularly pertinent topics. And the one that has to do with love that we've recently put out is social media addiction. Because what that video says is basically, hey, you can choose between spending another hour online or another hour with your family and friends.
Right. So,
okay, what's going to give you the most love?
I always think about that cliched story, like on their deathbed, nobody wished they'd spent one extra hour at work. They would want that extra hour with their family. And in class today, I actually applied that to cell phones because I had watched your video last night. And I said thing to the kids, I'm like, no one on their deathbed is going to wish they spent 5 more minutes playing a video game or another hour on their cell phone, but they're going to want more memories of their families on a vacation or cuddling with their significant other, or, you know, that's what they're going to want. And I got a few kids who nodded and a lot of kids who ignored me, but you know, it's teenagers. What can you do?
And the problem with that is that cell phones are immediate gratification. You get the dopamine release. straight away. Whereas let's just say, you know, spending another hour with your significant other on the couch. Now, that sounds like a whole lot of fun, but if you had an argument with them just 2 hours ago, it takes a bit of effort to get to that fun. And so all the love that I talk about in the book takes initial effort. But what it does is it gives you long-term contentment rather than immediate pleasure. And so we're actually in a dopamine crisis, and dopamine is a brain chemical that mediates pleasure in our brain. And with our screens, we can have that pleasure instantaneously. But if you want a good relationship, I'm sorry, that is not instantaneous.
No, they always take work. Absolutely.
They take work, which means that you're putting in effort for a better future. And this is the decision that we're making often. Do I get a little bit of pleasure now, or do I put in the effort now for a better future? Mm-hmm. And it's actually always better to put in the effort for a better future, because you end up with not only dopamine, but also serotonin, where it makes you feel at home. Oxytocin, of course, is the love drug, where you feel that rush of emotion, love, but also trust. Whenever businessmen shake hands and say, you got a deal, okay, there's oxytocin flowing there, okay? And the other chemical I want to talk about is called beta endorphins. And a lot of people know about beta endorphins because if you run a lot, you will get this rush of endorphins to take down your pain.
But the runner's high.
The runner's high. But we also get beta endorphins from laughing together, crying together, mm-hmm. telling jokes together, playing music together, singing together, or just having a conversation with somebody. So the idea that beta endorphin is there to bring your pain levels down, well, there's a purpose for that. And the purpose, I believe, is that you want your pain levels down so you can spend more time with other people. Mm-hmm. Because let's say if you're in an orchestra and you've got a flute solo coming up and your hand hurts.
I play flute, actually.
Do you? Okay, good. Well, if you've got a solo coming up, you can't stop the orchestra and say, sorry, this hurts too much. You know,
I'm not
going to play the solo.
I'm not holding this up anymore. Right.
That's right. You're going to hold it up and your brain is going to release beta endorphins because you're doing the music and you're doing this with a whole lot of people, so that for those 2 minutes, you can do your solo and people can go, oh, that was beautiful. She was part of it. So there's a purpose behind the analgesic effect of beta endorphins.
So that just solved a question for me. I haven't done it in a while since COVID started, but for 20 years, I've been singing with a local community choir.
Yeah.
And when I stand still for too long, my lower back hurts.
Yes.
But I could stand and sing for an hour and have no pain.
Yes. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, I never knew why until this moment.
Okay, and so that's
it was always a mystery. Why can I stand while I'm singing, but I can't stand other places? Yeah.
Yeah, because your brain says this is good for us. It's good for us to be standing with other people.
Feels good everywhere.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic. Yes. Makes life worthwhile.
Wow. I love learning stuff.
That's so nice. Yeah, beta endorphin is actually, it's an amazing chemical, and it shows that we're social creatures, all right? So if you ever wonder how a flock of a million birds can just sort of go into the sky at the same second.
And then they turn.
That's right, the fish, they just turn sort of all of a sudden.
I love that schooling fish thing. Oh, my God.
Yes. There is some of that in us. And we see it the most when we engage in music. Because to me, when I'm part of an orchestra and the conductor brings down the baton and 100 people sing the same thing at exactly the same time, that to me is a miracle. But that is all mediated through beta endorphins, because we are together and we feel connected and there's something going on that isn't going on beforehand. And look, I'm just going to take another example for that.
I'm enjoying this. This is fun.
Okay, we've got the Winter Olympics going on at the moment.
Right.
And the amazing thing about the Olympic Games, I particularly like the gymnastics.
Yes, me too.
Okay.
In the Summer Olympics.
Figure skating. Okay, let's take figure skating because that's on at the moment. How is it that people do better than their personal best when they're at the Olympics? That always amazes me. And one of the answers is beta endorphins, because
from the audience, everybody wants focusing.
Yes, everybody is focusing. There's silence, but that is a silence that's full of this energy. And so this is where we get this idea of flow, when you're flowing with the audience to do something better than you could possibly do yourself.
Right.
And you will feel this with your significant other when you're just flowing together, mm-hmm. right? When you say, hey, we're really syncing at the moment, right?
Yeah.
Being together. Or when the family is just humming, or when you're with a group of friends around a campfire and you go, hey, there's something happening here. And that's all right. beta endorphin mediated, that there is something bigger than yourself. And you're flowing with the human race. You're flowing with the people around you. And that is a form of love.
Yeah. I can think of instances of small dinner parties at my house where everybody was laughing and we were feeling that exact same thing, or yeah. playing games with all of the kids and
yeah.
it's snowing outside and we're inside with a Monopoly game, but it just
yes.
feels like, you know, everybody's in flow. Or
yes.
or it happens to me quite regularly when I'm in my classes with my students and we're all writing at the same time and
yes.
everybody's creatively thinking, even though we're
yes.
all separate and no one's talking. Sometimes
yes.
I write my best things that way.
Yes, yes, because we're, 40 or 50 people are together in a classroom and you're not by yourself. You are part of something bigger.
Right.
You're learning something outside yourself. You're growing in life with the people around you. And then you as a teacher feel, this is what life's about.
Yeah.
I'm actually doing something worthwhile here. And it's very hard to even articulate what that is.
Sure. It just feels like you know what it is when you feel it. You know, you recognize
yeah.
it when you feel it.
Yeah.
Awesome. Okay, so I think it's time for the seven questions, if you're ready.
The seven questions. Okay, let's have seven questions.
Okay, so what six words would you use to describe yourself?
Six words to describe myself. That's very hard, Marcy. That's very hard.
Okay.
Okay, so I am highly emotional, empathic, compassionate, fun, childlike, and playful.
Lovely.
But I do get angry sometimes as well.
Oh, so does everyone.
So let's put that in as a word as well.
Okay. What is your favorite way to spend a day?
Wow. Okay.
It could be seasonally dependent, you know.
Yeah. Okay. So my spouse, Caroline, she's into favorites. What I will say often is I like the variety. So mm-hmm. I can love a day alone at the beach. I can love a day alone together with Caroline, just together doing whatever we do. If that's organizing another podcast or something, we flow together there. Or I could be with a group of people. And I use the metaphor of an orchestra a lot because I've spent a lot of time conducting and playing in orchestras.
Yes.
And there's something very special that happens there. So my ideal day is spent with people touching real issues and sharing feelings of love in the broader sense.
Awesome. Excellent.
Okay.
What is your favorite childhood memory? Here's a favorite, but yeah. Okay.
So my favorite childhood memory actually has to do with being in community. I was lucky to grow up in a church community where we saw the same people every weekend. And that just gave such a sense of familiarity and belonging. It gave a sense of belonging and being part of a community. And yes, I did music as part of this community. I sang as part of this community. And you just took it for granted. You took adults and fellow children all for granted because that's the way I thought life was supposed to be.
I think you might be onto something. I think that might be how life is supposed to be. I find myself watching a lot of TV shows lately that have very close-knit groups of friends in them.
Yeah.
You know, and since the whole COVID thing, I have hardly seen my friends because yeah. we're all isolated and nobody's getting together and we're not going to places where there are lots of people. So, you know, it's been sad.
Well, it has been
it's
sad.
It's been a loss.
Yeah. And so yesterday I had the experience of going to a funeral of somebody who's dear to me and part of that community. But it meant that I saw people that I haven't seen for about 30 or 40 years.
Wow.
And yeah, and because we moved away, we got into another life, but
sure.
to just relive some of that community again, where the silliest things were so important,
mm-hmm.
and that somehow made life very worthwhile for me yesterday.
Yeah, so a sad occasion brought you some joy. So that's
brought a lot of joy. Yeah,
that's wonderful. I think yeah. that's what these funeral rituals are about.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Thank you for the question.
Sure. What is your favorite meal?
My favorite meal, Again, I have many favorite meals, but I think a good spaghetti bolognese is my favorite simply because it's usually cooked with love.
Yeah.
Somebody has not
it's
just let the ingredients.
Comfort food for sure. Yeah.
Yes. Yes. And they said, I'm just going to put this together and I'm going to make it just like that. And also in our family, we had it at least once a week, and it had always good memories of somebody coming up while I was making this meal, sort of saying, what are we having tonight for dinner? Spaghetti bolognese, that's great. You know, so a lot of good memories around spaghetti.
I think
bolognese.
I made it at least once a week when my kids were little.
Fantastic.
Or younger, when the kids were home. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's easy.
Fantastic.
Too.
Yeah, it is.
And it always comes out well. What one piece of advice would you give your younger self?
No need to worry. Mm-hmm. I've made that cardinal mistake that many of us do, worrying about the things that you can't control.
Of course.
So silly things like the weather, whether people like you or not, and not spending enough time on the things that you can control, like how you spend your time or what you say to people in the heat of an argument. Mm-hmm. That's a time when you can sort of think, Christian, is this the right thing to say? Okay, just
take a deep breath.
About it.
Right.
That's
respond.
Right.
Respond right. Instead of react.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. What is one thing you would like to change about the world?
Oh, the first word that came to me was everything. It could use a little of that. I know we're here and it'd be nice to say that we should get rid of all these problems. But problems, in a way, is what keeps us going and keeps us thriving. I suppose the one thing that I want to change is that it'd be nice if we could move together in the same direction to solve these problems rather than move in separate directions, because we ultimately all want the same thing. Mm-hmm. We want to be able to have a good time and a meaningful time, but we're actually almost going to war over how that should be done. And I'd like to change that.
It's actually a good way of looking at it. If we could move together in the same direction to solve the problems that we all commonly share, we'd actually have a shot at solving at least some of them.
Yeah, we would. And look, having treated a lot of people who have post-traumatic stress disorder from war situations, I never see war as a solution to anything.
No,
and
it isn't.
If we
it
head
just
in
makes
that direction,
more problems.
It makes huge problems. In fact, a lot of the problems of my life are still those that were left over from the Second World War. Okay,
right.
So if we could have somehow averted, that would have been good. I know that's a very complex thing to do, but...
Well, you know, I've been looking at my own family and talking about intergenerational trauma a lot,
yes.
Like helping me examine the experiences that I've had in my life with my mom and my grandmother, and putting that in the context of my grandmother, who was born in 1915, her life full of experience and trauma, and her mother, my great-grandmother, who emigrated from Russia during the times of the pogroms when Jews were being killed,
yeah.
And all of that and the Depression and both world wars greatly affected the
yes.
way these women were brought up and then affected my life.
Yes.
And by looking at myself as one member in this continuity of this family, completely changed the pathology of victimizing myself, because I no
yeah.
longer looked at myself that way. I was
yeah.
it was just like this big weight that lifted off of me looking at it from that direction.
Well, that's fantastic, because right there you articulated how you're not just an individual, but you're part of something greater, not only with the people
right.
around you now, but throughout history.
Yeah.
And when we start to bring in history, it unites all of us. We're all part of the same larger family that we call the human race.
Exactly.
And yeah, it'd be good to just pull in the same direction.
It's beautiful. Beautiful. Okay. Now getting a little cheesy and a little modern, and I know you're like anti-screens, but you have to, what TV shows do you binge and watch and love? I'm just curious
right.
about this.
Okay.
I mean, assuming you watch TV, you know, I don't know.
Okay, so occasionally my spouse and I find something that sort of speaks to us, and it usually has something to do with family values out in nature and basically people working things out. So I'm going to tell you about the last one that we got into, because this was on Netflix Australia. It was a series from the 1990s called Sea Change, where a high-profile Melbourne lawyer decides to give up the rat race to go to this small town on the ocean and to start to care for some of the people who are leading very ordinary lives, or so it seems. And the message of the whole thing is actually, you know what? It's people. You care about people, however quirky they are, whatever their past is, whatever they're into. If you can start to care for people, that is worth gold. So, yeah, so that one's called Sea Change, and it's on Netflix Australia.
Nice. That was very cool. Well, thank you so much for this. This was so wonderful. I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you for being on Permission to Heal and telling us about your book. All of the links to your socials and your website and how to buy your books and everything will be in the show notes. So if you're not driving while you're listening to this, you can just scroll down and they'll all be there. So
yes. And I just want to say one more thing, Marcy.
Besides, just go ahead.
Thank you for all of that. And thank you for those questions.
Oh, you're welcome.
Loving yourself is giving yourself permission to heal.
There you go. Can't think of a better way to end. That's great.
Thank you for the work that you're doing, because it is vitally important. It gives so much to so many people.
Thank you so much. When my own healing journey began after my divorce and my mother's death, art and creativity were there to help me process decades of trauma and pain. And through art, painting and writing, I found my authentic self. I wrote my book, Permission to Land, Searching for Love, Home, and Belonging, as a way to share my healing journey with the world. I found my way out of the darkness of mental illness and addiction into the light of a healthy life I intentionally created for myself and my children, ending the intergenerationality of it all. To get your own personally signed hardcover or paperback copies of Permission to Land, Searching for Love, Home, and Belonging, and the companion journal book, Permission to Heal, Personal Transformation Through Writing, go to my website, marcibrockmann.com, MarciBrockmann.com. Use my Amazon affiliate links to get your own Kindle or audiobook version of Permission to Land to help support my Permission to Heal podcast. Use the links in the show notes of this podcast episode. Thank you so much for listening. And remember, you only need your own permission to live your best life. Thank you for joining me for this episode of Permission to Heal. I hope you found it moving and inspirational. Please remember, you don't need anyone else's permission to trust and follow your heart. You have the power within you. Subscribe to Permission to Heal so you don't miss any new episodes, and please share this with your friends.